Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
Michael, I wanted to tell you, I was in San Francisco, and I saw there is, we talked a little bit on the Sucker Punch show about Zero Friends, Alex Pardee's
yes.
sort of art
yeah.
thing, people collaboration deal.
Uh-huh.
There's some sort of establishment in San Francisco, a physical location that you can go. It was not open when I was there.
Huh.
But I was in San Francisco for a show that LP did with Killer Mike, which was also great because they have this project together now called Run the Jewels.
Mm-hmm.
They've had it for a while, but I saw a Run the Jewels show where the openers, so Run the Jewels is LP and Killer Mike,
mm-hmm.
and then the openers were LP and Killer Mike.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to see a full LP set, a full Killer Mike set, and then the two of them do a full set.
That's awesome. Great.
But yeah, anyways, Alex Pardee has some sort of, it looks like a business establishment that you can walk in, and I don't know what you can do because it wasn't open, but I'm dying to go in there. In the window was just a bunch of his fucking artwork.
Huh.
And it's great, and I love it.
That's awesome.
We should get Alex Pardee to, do you think he'd do like artwork for our show? I don't know what we need artwork for. But
Maybe for a shirt that says Death to Double Feature.
I would replace our cover art with, that's what we should do, is instead of me mining and remastering cover art every mm-hmm. week, we should just get Alex Pardee to paint some kind of double feature thing.
Yeah.
We're doing movies in schools or something today.
Sure.
We had a good one. It was actually The Hidden Truths of Future and Past.
Yeah.
Today on the show. What are, now that we're 7 minutes in, what are all the two movies that we're doing?
We're doing Class of 1984, circa 1982. And
thanks for getting that out of the way.
A young buck named John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness,
otherwise known as one of the John Carpenter movies we haven't done yet.
One of the three.
This one, okay, hold on. This one is not on us.
Right.
Because actually, Bastion, who gave to our Kickstarter, big thanks on that, by the way. He goes, hey, I got a movie for you to do. You're going to do Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
Now, one might look at our history and go, wow, that certainly is a waste of your money, Bastion, because we were probably going to do that on a long enough timeline anyways. But he thought, hey, maybe you guys won't be around much longer, and I need to make sure Prince of Darkness gets covered.
Well, and let's also keep in mind that with the sheer amount of John Carpenter that we cover, it's possible that Prince of Darkness may not make it till the end of that list, and we still have maybe 4 or 5 more John Carpenter movies to do.
Well, we'll get into that when we talk about Prince of Darkness. But if you've never ever heard of this show before, one, it's great. And two, it has spoilers in it. So there's a feature called Chapters. You can skip over the spoilers. And we're gonna have two conversations where the Class of 1984 and Prince of Darkness are, for at least the duration of this show, the two greatest films ever made.
Yeah, I think so.
And equally as good, let's also say. They're both tied for first place.
For the greatest film ever made.
Which is funny because I'm pretty sure last week wasn't The Prowler and When a Stranger Calls the best films ever made?
Yeah, they were. I mean, we've been doing a really good thing where we end up finding the best films ever made and then we put them on the show. We've been able to pull this
and then
off.
We find two that are even better, I guess. I don't know.
Well, next week. Hold on. Next week.
All right. Well, maybe we'll just back away from this. Anyways, my point was, I want to talk about the Class of 1984.
Okay.
Which is the first of two movies that has Alice Cooper in it.
Yes.
So let's talk about Canadian punk.
Yeah.
Let's talk about where we should start is the backdrop of this, because the movie starts with what strikes me as a very sensitive intro.
Yeah.
It's, hey, things are bad. This is kind of based on real events. But fortunately, there's nothing like this as of yet.
Right. Well, it's set in a not too distant future.
Yeah.
2 years.
2 years away. Yeah, I like to think this is kind of how movies tried to capitalize on the year 2000. You know, 1999 and 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was coming up with a year 2000 something. And I think in 1982 and 1983, people were going, oh, everybody's going to be thinking about Orwell's 84. You know, we should have something that says, this is our last chance to go. 1984 could be like 1984.
Right.
You know, and put that out.
Yeah, so the film basically takes place in an anarchist high school.
Mm-hmm.
You get this new teacher who comes in out of nowhere. Kids are handing each other razor blades. The school is basically run by gangs. They're selling drugs. They're disrespecting the authorities. Roddy McDowell, who we know from Fright Night,
yeah,
carries a gun to his biology class.
Sure, sure.
It's a, I mean, granted, it's a hamster gun, but it is no less
right.
a weapon to illustrate the gravity of crime going on in this high school. And we get scenes that take place outside of the school.
Mm-hmm.
People walking down the street, various scenes of people driving, just some setup, you know, establishing shots.
We get to learn the town a little bit.
And the town seems pretty nice.
Yeah. Isn't that the crazy part?
The town is not an anarchistic ruin of a place where people are bleeding sure. out in the street. It's the
whole
school.
World hasn't gone to hell in two right. years. It's just the schools.
And that's I think one of the biggest points that the film is making, right? Is that the world isn't hell, but our future is hell.
Yeah, right.
Because that's the thing, right? There's the, what's the, children are the future.
Yeah.
Isn't that a thing people say?
Future leaders.
Right. Yeah. Today's children are tomorrow's grown-ups.
Good. Astute point you've made.
Anyway, so we have the future leaders of tomorrow.
Thank you. There it is.
They're fucking punks.
Yeah, right.
And they're stabbing each other and they're doing drugs and falling off of flagpoles. I mean, it's really, it's a scary notion to think that we will, in a few short years, have
fall
a nation.
Off flagpoles.
Right. Well, or just have a nation run by criminals.
Yeah, that's definitely a fear that I think exists in culture is you look at kids and you don't think about, you just think, what if they were adults? What if they were running things?
Right.
You know,
well, there's
the Star Trek kind of idea of
right.
the,
Tranya.
You know, the town.
Oh.
Town run by children, you
sure.
know, when there's no adults.
Right.
The Lord of the Flies
right.
situation. And I think we forget that, you know, there's some growing up to do.
Right.
And everybody was a little asshole when they were when
yeah.
they were kids.
But it's really interesting because I'm going to refer to this film from now on as Mr. Holland's Opus with a Vengeance.
Okay, sure.
Because we get this music teacher slash do-gooder slash generally likable protagonist, which I think is one of the strongest things you can have in a cult 80s flick,
uh-huh.
is a protagonist who you recognize, not as an actor, but in a scene.
Right.
You go, that's the guy.
Sure.
Because so often we watch, I mean, we've seen so many slasher movies that at this point I couldn't tell you
who was in which one.
Which blonde or right. which chiseled jawed brown haired fellow right. was which.
Right, right.
I don't know which one Kevin Bacon was in.
Yeah, sure.
But you get a really good, solid lead character, and he's incredibly benevolent, almost to a fault, ready to follow the rules because he believes that the system works,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, as we've seen in any society with any sort of criminal rule, any organized crime will show you that the system fails because the organized crime seeps into the system.
Sure.
Or they just figure out a way around it. And in this film, it's really easy because the organized crime is under 18.
Yeah, that's a weird point they make, isn't it?
Yeah.
There seems to be a case they're making for less legal protection for minors. I mean, I don't know if that's just a plot point or that's really something. What do you think's to be done about this? I mean, if the idea is we don't want it to come to this, I don't know if the movie's proposing a way in which we stop it.
I think spank your kids, I think.
Is
what
that
the
what
film
the movie's
saying? Film is spanky. Well, because we get the scene where we go back to the leader, the evil leader's home, and his mother, you know,
pampers him,
and he gets to do whatever he wants, and she defends him to no end, and he's
That's
just a good little boy.
Yeah,
I mean, the kid was raised getting anything he wanted and never got spanked. So spank your kids. I don't actually believe. That people should spank their children. I don't know what you're supposed to do.
I was going
to
say that might be a strange pacifistic point between you and I, where I don't know if we're on the same page.
I feel like if I were to ever have to raise a child, now keep in mind, I've already admitted the disconnect that it won't be my own. I just have to raise one.
Right.
If I ever have to raise a child, the way that I'm going to hopefully raise that child to be a good, upstanding member of society is I'm going to treat them like an adult for their whole life.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to, if they complain, I'm going to tell them to stop complaining. They don't have to go to work.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think that there are ways to raise wonderful, upstanding adults that don't involve hitting them.
Sure.
But I'm sure that there are also wonderful, upstanding adults who were spanked.
I'm in the same camp as you. I don't know anything about raising kids, but I think I'm pretty firmly in the no physical abuse camp.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to compare spanking a kid to, say, punching them in the face.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain different levels
right.
of physical abuse.
Sure.
And I don't want to discount, you know, incredibly violent domestic situations by equating them to spanking, which mm-hmm. is probably lower on the gradient. Having said that, could still fuck a person up
sure.
and is probably unnecessary.
Right.
And I don't think fosters are, I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about, right. but that's where I stand as a pacifist on spanking.
Right. And fortunately, with Class of 1984, the line is very black and white. It's knives and guns, and I mean, people are stabbing sure. people in the lunchroom.
It's violence or not violence, right. so I'm on the not violence side of that.
Right, agreed.
Yeah, the movie definitely does have something to say, though, about, you know, using violence and using this sort of vigilante effort,
mm-hmm.
taking matters into your own hands. Before we get terribly into that, you were talking a little bit about this school and how, you know, sort of shocking it is seeing the area they're in where it's kind of gangland.
Right.
It's a lot of elements from, if you did a movie about prison, you know, I think
mm-hmm.
you would use a lot of those things to convey what's going on in the schools in 1984. And there's something interesting to be said about how a lot of kids feel like they're in prison
mm-hmm.
when they're in school. Sure. They have all this control over them. Not what I think the movie's driving at. But I was wondering, as you're watching this, especially now in comparison to 82 when the movie was made, you get in there and there's metal detectors, first of all,
mm-hmm.
which I think is supposed to be the big shock, but
sure.
probably isn't any longer because
no.
a lot of schools have metal detectors.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're introduced to the school, what is that big shock moment for you?
For me, it's when the biology teacher has a gun.
So that's definitely the point where you're like, okay, we're in a fucking bad spot here.
Right. Well, because it's not only that he has a gun, it's that he's not even ashamed or
sure.
concerned that he might get found out.
Tucks it into his belt. He's right
there. He just goes, everybody's got something.
Right. What about in regards to the kids, though? I mean, that the gun certainly says something bad about the kids,
mm-hmm.
but actually seeing them, at what point do you go, wow, lost cause, terrible children?
I don't know. I always end up in the scene in the music room where the kids aren't supposed to be there, and then that whole
sure.
scene.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I like to feel like I'm not the type of person who just bows to authority and acquiesces when I'm told to do something,
mm-hmm.
I feel like the way the school system works is based on a general. It's a general system where you have to go to class and then the teacher will tell you what to do. And you're not necessarily sitting there and listening because you're acquiescing to the man.
Yeah.
You're sitting there because your day's activity requires you to learn and then succeed
yeah.
at learning.
Sure.
And so by showing up, which is mandatory,
right?
You have to show up. That's the one thing you have to accept.
Sure.
You can play hooky, you can ditch, but then you're technically doing something illegal.
Yeah.
So let's just say you have to show up. So you have to show up. And once you're there, your options are dick around and be horrible and disrespect everyone.
Right.
Or try to do the best job you can.
Sure.
Which I think is another point the film is getting at, is that these kids that are actually trying to learn can't because of these fucking horrible, violent monsters that disrupt every single aspect
sure.
of them
sure.
of them succeeding. And I think that's where the real crime lies. You get these people stabbing and killing each other, but it turns into more of a cancer because by having, you know, X amount of criminals in a class, that whole class goes down.
Sure.
And so you breed that many more uneducated or undereducated creatures that then go on to produce more un or undereducated creatures. And I think that is really the appropriation of the problem. And so the scene in the music room where it's supposed to be a class and it's the teacher's first thing. And they kind of do, it seems at first like hazing a sub.
Yeah, right.
But it quickly turns into a level of disrespect.
This is just the way it is.
It just turns into a level of disrespect that I'm just not familiar with.
Right. Well, and it's also constant. It seems like an average
exactly.
day for them.
Exactly.
Yeah. On paper, a couple extra kids in the class who are there even though they shouldn't be mm-hmm. almost seems redeemable.
Right.
It almost seems
bonus.
Like
bonus yeah, learners. It's,
oh, they're really interested in music. And then taking that thing that's on paper and, you know, looking at it, really having that kind of context for it, you know, it's a bad thing. You can't really put your finger on why extra kids in a class is a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
but they're there to fuck things up and to be dicks,
sure.
basically. And I mean, that's the thing, you know, there's graffiti on the walls and the way the school looks and stuff. That's very eye opening to me,
mm-hmm.
but just seeing the way the kids treat each other.
Yeah.
And this is something we've noticed throughout movies as we've been doing them on the show. And I think probably in our own lives, I mean, I think everybody's had some experience where kids are generally dickish to each other.
Yeah, kids are horrible. Kids are the worst.
In the great sort of bully awakening, mm-hmm. As much misinformation, I think, as there was as actual information or ideas in that whole kind of campaign in the last couple of years, we've really started paying a lot more attention to the fact that kids are dicks in schools. And I'm really interested in finding out why that is. But there's also something, you know, I've heard it said that everyone thinks they were bullied in school, but no one remembers being a bully in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that idea is very much true. I mean, you never really hear about somebody, you know, oh, yeah, high school was rough. I remember I'm picking on so many kids, mm-hmm. you know. You think back to everybody going, yeah, I had a shitty situation. Yeah, I mean, it was just horrible for me, and these kids picked on me, and I had a bad, I don't know, situation with my family or whatever. It's funny to think, if I were to try and remember, and I have no recollection of even having gone to school, my memory is so bad, but if I were to try and remember three instances of when I was, say, picked on in high school, I think the people I would remember as picking on me, if you would go ask them,
mm-hmm.
they would probably have people that they thought picked on them.
Right.
And I'm sure, even though I thought I was a really great kid in high school and I was super nice to everybody, I'm sure there's probably a ton of kids who, again, asked that same question, would go, yeah, that Eric guy was a huge dick to me. He made my life hell. He did X, Y, and Z thing that, I mean, maybe I wasn't even aware I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That just ruined his life. I wonder if maybe when you're young, you don't have something you get as you grow up that just tells you, I mean, navigating social situations is hard.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a bunch of people accidentally stepping on each other's toes. Is that possible?
I think that's
mixed with hormones.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think that is the catch 22 of being, especially in middle school and high school. You get it's the combination of lack of the human experience
mm-hmm.
combined with people trying to teach you the human experience.
Yeah, sure.
And so you're living in a situation where you honestly don't quite know how to be.
Right.
Meanwhile, everybody's telling you how to be, and you're trying to pick up signals from all your peers who are all being told how to be and all picking up signals from other peers.
Yeah.
And it becomes a big mess of convoluted red lights blinking, going, do this, be that, don't do this, don't be that.
Sure.
And yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of people who walk into school and go, I'm going to ruin this person's day.
Right.
And
right.
hopefully their life.
I think people are better than that.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Even when they're young.
It's difficult learning what kind of things you have to tiptoe around when you're
right.
first encountering a human being. What's going to offend them? What's going to make them think things? I mean, not to mention what's going to remind them of horrible things that have happened to them.
Well, it's also so easy to pick up negative things from your environment, too.
Right.
That's another thing the class of 1984 reminded me of, is how quickly, you know, they corrupt the teacher, for instance, or just having, I mean, those students all want to be in a clique. They want to be in a gang. That's
right.
why they gravitate towards, you know, they make that girl get naked and fuck them. They're mm-hmm. trying out drugs. They have a line of people standing there to audition to be in their gang. kids will formulate these cliques to have some kind of sense of belonging.
Right.
And then you also have, talking about some of the 1984 stuff, the oppressive nature of authority and wanting to be away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a hard parenting thing for me to get my head around, is I just have in life in general, I have a very laissez-faire kind of, you know, stay out of it philosophy, mm-hmm. about let people lead their own lives and, you know, not try and be oppressive about things. And that's something I hated school for. It's why I left as early as I did.
Right.
But I didn't find anything to guide me morally until creating these idols afterwards,
mm-hmm.
looking at different authors and, you know, seeing a lot of what Penn and Teller were doing in skepticism, reading Michael Shermer's books, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins. Anytime these guys were talking about morality was super fascinating to me because I didn't have any of that in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until after school that I developed any sort of code of ethics, how right. to treat other people. And I think I was just so resistant to authority, I couldn't do that in school. So maybe for me, that kind of style of raising a child, I mean, I don't know, they need some structure, obviously, mm-hmm. but how do you do that without seeming oppressive? And kids like this in the film, I think, are lashing out against that authority. They want to do right. things their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And they start lashing out. Other people see them do it. They want to join that clique. And they just start corrupting the entire unit. We only see four or five real bad kids.
Mm-hmm.
But that group isn't, I mean, the whole high school is fucked up.
Right.
So clearly everybody's pretty bad, or there's a large element that's pretty bad. They just don't look as bad compared to, you know, Stegman and mm-hmm. his kids. And then the teacher comes in, and as you mentioned, great guy. We all like him. Totally honest guy coming in here. And, I mean, he breaks into that drug deal. He starts throwing Stegman around in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he pushes him into the bathroom. Stegman does the, you know, yeah. the whole self.
Right.
He puts on the show. But then he confronts Stegman at home.
Uh-huh.
Breaks into his car.
Sure.
You know, these are not ethical choices.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he's corrupted by that environment
sure.
by going, what other choice do I have?
Sure. Well, he goes, he's put in a situation where everything he does within the system goes, yeah, but that doesn't work now.
Sure.
You can't bust him for drugs because you have no proof.
Right.
Well, you have to, how are you going to get proof? I mean, you basically have to, you know, get him at home.
Right.
Oh, okay.
You have to be holding their hand yeah. while they're mugging you or whatever.
Yeah.
Andy Norris was not prosecuted because the police could not find anyone that actually saw it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of idea. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's not the takeaway you're supposed to have about this movie, but I see Class of 1984 as a movie about how someone's surrounding can corrupt that
sure.
individual. I see that in the teachers trying to run each other down with cars.
Right.
And especially Norris's, I mean, he mutilates and kills these kids
right.
at the end.
Well, they push so hard.
Right.
I mean, the kids are just basically goofing off in a very dangerous way.
Right.
And you even end up wondering, well, what choice does this guy have?
Sure.
What can he do to stop this? They've officially raped his wife four times.
Right. Right.
And you go, this is, I mean, yeah, I guess you have to kill him. Don't wait. No, because your wife just wanted to leave.
Yeah, she had the best idea, which is, this is actually out of our hands. Let's back away from this situation.
Yeah.
Sometimes that might be the only answer. Otherwise, you're mowing down children with your car and sawing their arms off.
Right.
But I don't know. As always, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Prince of Darkness from 1987.
Yeah.
Is a movie in which Marilyn Manson gets his samples for his cover of Gary Numan's Down in the Park.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the last of my expertise on this. Who did this movie again?
I believe his name was John Carpenter.
Jonathan Carpenter.
But I don't want to talk about John Carpenter before we talk about Alice Cooper.
Oh, please.
So Alice Cooper.
Who had done the theme of,
for Class of 1984.
Yeah.
And he actually does a song in Prince of Darkness, but it's really, really, really quiet.
What do you mean?
In one of the scenes. They turn it way, way... In the scene where Alice Cooper impales a guy with a bicycle.
Sure, yeah.
There's a really...
Using his infamous impaler thing.
Right. There's a really quiet... There's a really quiet Alice Cooper song playing underneath that scene.
Oh,
it's really weird. But yeah, Alice Cooper is in this film. And also Alice Cooper is on the cover of this film.
Right.
Which is hilarious because Alice Cooper is not only barely in the film, but not...
I don't think he has a line, does he?
No. He's also not the Prince of Darkness in this film. No. Which would be easy, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be easy to just have the homeless guy end up getting possessed and have that be Alice Cooper and there you go.
Yeah,
you've
weird,
got Alice Cooper is the devil and everybody's happy. I love, fucking love Alice Cooper.
Sure.
If you like Rob Zombie, you have to like Alice Cooper.
Well, and Alice Cooper also did, while we're talking about a bunch of my heroes... He and James Randi went on tour for, I think, many years. I'm not 100% positive, but Randi, back when Randi was, you know, truly the amazing Randi, mm-hmm. and not now when everybody knows him as James Randi, J-Ref James Randi, and talks about how he was the amazing Randi. But I mean, when that was his career.
Right.
And he was out doing magic and stage shows. He was touring with Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
And so these guys, it's very much pieces of my world coming together.
So Alice Cooper has little to nothing to do with this film. However, this is probably the closest we're ever going to get to an Alice Cooper double feature.
Well, I just did a bit on James Randi, who has nothing to do with this film. So that's not about to stop us.
But I fucking love Alice Cooper. I like everything he represents. Alice Cooper, okay, just to give everybody a very, very, very simple crash course into why Alice Cooper's great, and it'll kind of get us right into Prince of Darkness. Alice Cooper recently did an interview with Fuse where he had discovered that the Lumineers, don't know if you're familiar, they're basically kind of a folk band,
mm-hmm.
got named Best New Rock Band on Rolling Stone or Spin or whatever magazine.
Sure.
And Alice Cooper, obviously being Alice fucking Cooper, he didn't like that. He didn't think that was fair that the Lumineers, because they have guitars, I guess, in their band, all acoustic, they shouldn't be called the best new rock band or whatever. So
sure.
Alice Cooper basically said, and this is now, this is, don't take this at face value. Take this as kind of a philosophical statement. But he says, you know, I feel like this whole generation just needs to eat a steak.
Listen, you're talking to me in Cupertino, California.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I've been a vegetarian some fucking 15 years or something, and I want to eat a steak every day. I absolutely know what you're talking about. I miss that about the Alice Cooper generation.
Yeah.
I miss that, that just element of rebellion.
Right. Well, that's what he says. He says that
fuck the man.
Rock and roll, if you're rock and roll, you're an outlaw. You don't make clog dancing music. Right. You don't play guitar. When you play guitar, it's an electric guitar and you play it down here with your groin, you know? You play play it down with your pelvis. You don't play it up here, then you're not happy.
Sure.
You feel it.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, that's a lot of what attracts me to hip hop now.
Yeah. Because
there's a lot of hip hop that has seen what mainstream hip hop is doing. It's very egocentric.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always going to be, you know, I mean, that's just a huge element of it. But they're going, let's do a different thing by talking about that that underdog spirit.
Right.
And that resistance to,
yeah,
you know, the overlords, even when they're,
mm-hmm.
they're only, that you also get a lot of crazy stuff in hip hop.
Right.
Where it's the Illuminati's out to get us, and
mm-hmm.
Killer Mike did 20 minutes of a set about fuck Ronald Reagan and the oppression of the Reagan administration. So you also get some crazy in there.
Right.
But there is that spirit, that fuck the man kind of spirit, that rebellion.
I feel like John Carpenter is the Alice Cooper of horror films. I feel like he's been there from the beginning.
Sure.
He's been doing the whole horror show. Everybody knows him.
Right.
And now it's the mid-90s, and he's not about to stop being John Carpenter just because it's 1990.
You know, we did Existenz, and I talked about how I didn't know there was classic Cronenberg left.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that way about John Carpenter with as much as we've covered, and especially kind of coming into this period in the 90s.
Right.
I thought it was just all definitively this different type of popcorn embracing Escape from LA, John Carpenter.
Vampires.
Yeah. And this is especially dealing with the subject matter. I thought we're in for that again. And, you know, Victor Wong being from Big Trouble in Little China. I thought it's all Big Trouble in Little China from here on out.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, we have a heavy John Carpenter movie again.
Right.
We have one that is still at its heart those elements that you just can't not have in a Carpenter movie. It's the monster element and the scares that are almost a little funny.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a little funny in the way that they were a little funny in The Thing.
Right.
Not in Big Trouble in Little China.
Right.
And I wonder if the gravity of this is Donald Pleasance. Maybe that's what it took.
The gravity is always Donald Pleasance.
It's just something that I think he immediately brings with him.
Mm-hmm.
Who's he? Father Loomis, I think.
Yeah.
Loomis, I don't know if we, I think we mentioned on the Psycho show, you know, a callback to the Halloween reference, which is a callback to Loomis Hardware in Psycho. So he's in this church and it's an odd textured kind of setting that is, it creates a very distinctive mood.
Mm-hmm.
You have all of this religious stuff we're going to start talking about. It's one of the central themes of the movie. And, you know, we have this father who's a central character. And then on top of all of that, we have the technology. So it's these two different, almost competing elements coming together,
right,
which is a lot of what the movie's about in invoking science to talk about religion. That's essentially what the movie is. It's science talking about religion. So you're in this building with the, you know, all these crucifixes everywhere and the paintings, religious paintings, candles littering every room. I mean, it looks like a no fucking around temple. And then you have the lamps and the lights and the analysis equipment, computers, recording equipment, very cutting edge. We're trying to do science here, people. And outside is this collection of, oh, I don't know, homeless people and bugs and worms.
Right.
You know, just to add one more, as if the religion and the technology together didn't make a distinctive enough feeling. Every time you look out the window, there's a bunch of homeless people staring in at you who, I don't know, collapse in complete blackness into a pile of cockroaches.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly distinct, I think.
Sure.
I wanted to know your take on anytime I start hearing quantum mechanics invoked, I get a little scared. And I think it's very tricky to do it right because quantum mechanics, as they mention in this movie, I mean, it's way hard to understand.
Yeah.
Right? Way fucking hard. It's not a matter of trust your audience. You know, they'll get it. Talking about in this movie, the inherently counterintuitive nature of theoretical physics, that's a lot of what quantum mechanics is.
Right.
And so people will use quantum mechanics distort really what it's about for fake science, for scams or other falsehoods to propagate their misinformation and make it sound like it's grounded in reality. And so there's a lot of misinformation about quantum mechanics.
Sure.
And I don't know about it. So I don't even know. I only know on the surface what's bad science and non-science and what's theoretical science. It's a very strange line. So they're invoking quantum mechanics to talk about religion. I mean, I don't know. Give me your take on that.
Well, first off, I actually took a quantum physics class.
Wow.
In one of the 2 years I went to college.
You impress me more every day.
So I know a lot more about it than the average person, which is to say I know almost nothing because I took one class. So not only did I take one class, but it was called quantum physics, right?
Sure.
It wasn't called...
Oh, so it's just going to cover all of it, huh?
Application of Schrodinger's theory.
Right.
You know, it was quantum physics for a semester.
Right. 40-minute course, took a break for lunch in the middle.
Yeah, you know, you learn all the big anchor points and just basically the thought style of quantum physics, which is one of the most difficult things about it. And I think that what this film does really, really interestingly, and I think fairly effectively, is it essentially goes quantum mechanics and the whole quantum theory is really difficult to understand because it operates just outside of our typical understanding of the physical world, which is to say that something like light can be both a particle and a wave and also have no mass but also be made of particles.
Yeah.
Stuff like that where on paper you go, okay, well, you can say that, but that sounds like total crap.
Right. Yeah,
but then they go, and here is some evidence to illustrate why that is our theory.
Sure.
Then suddenly you go, well, that evidence does seem to stand up to your hypothesis, and doesn't seem like
sounds like you're still doing science, Michael.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You go, well, that your hypothesis seems completely outlandish. However, you have evidence to support it and nobody can prove it wrong. So I have to kind of go, well, maybe that's an option.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of a hard and fast rule of just whenever quantum mechanics is invoked, I try to get to the core of, is what they're saying that quantum mechanics proves we don't really know anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the argument that people who believe in fucking nonsense, that's what they're always truly getting at.
Sure.
The what the bleep do we know?
Right.
Hey, since the discovery of quantum mechanics, we found that science knows fucking nothing, and therefore you should buy my magic energy bracelet.
Well, and that's why this film is perfect, because it goes, so we have quantum mechanics, which is an evidence-based thing that goes, here is something that may restructure our entire understanding of the physical world. But, you know, it seems crazy and it's really difficult to prove. Another thing that seems crazy and is really difficult to prove is religion. So maybe they're connected in some way. Maybe the Venn diagram overlaps somewhere.
Right.
I love the part where Donald Pleasance is talking about it's in the smallest pieces of the smallest part,
sure,
smaller than the atom. That's where the devil is.
Right, right.
In a nutshell, what the film is doing is going, the devil and evil is a scientific, it's a scientific physical thing. It's out of the supernatural. It is completely natural. It is in a tube.
Right.
And fortunately, we've been able to keep it in there.
Yeah.
But it is part of our world. It's a thing that happens. It's always been here. And the Catholic Church knew about it and lied about it because they didn't think people would buy it. So they're spewing all this bullshit.
So they made up some poetry,
right,
about how it's the evil in every man.
Right.
Devil actually lives in a tube. Not the evil, right, in every,
well, but
man.
That's the thing, is what it basically boils down to is if the tube ever opens, suddenly the evil in every man, it will spread like a virus,
right,
into every person, and that's how evil will truly spread.
Yeah.
And then it's juxtaposed against this really brief kind of offhanded, there was a supernova and the light is just reaching us today. So then we get back to the idea of photons and waves are particles, and these are particles moving at speeds that we've never ever been able to capture. And technically, if they're moving faster than the speed of light, that makes them a tachyon, which makes them moving back in time, but they're still reaching us. So now are we reverting? And that's why the homeless people are losing their minds, because they're out in the sun, and the worms and the ants are all becoming prey to this hyperactive reversion.
Sure.
And so the film brilliantly goes, so the devil is real. The devil is science. And then they just start throwing, and now this is where, I mean, what you and I would normally call bullshit, but what, because John Carpenter is doing it, I will call art.
Uh-huh.
John Carpenter goes, here's the theory, the quantum theory,
mm-hmm,
here's the idea, and then he gives the exemplary, the same thing, it's basically Schrodinger's cat, right? Schrodinger never put a cat in a box and killed it. It didn't happen. It's a theoretical cat in a theoretical box.
Sure.
So it's basically the same principle as if Schrodinger was like, okay, imagine there's a savior in a cave.
Right.
And the cave is closed.
Sure.
So what John Carpenter's doing is he goes, okay, so imagine there's a god, right?
Yeah.
Now in a parallel universe, there's an anti-god, right? Now say somehow that the anti-god in a parallel universe crossed that barrier and is now here. And so what is light to the anti-god is eternal darkness to us, and that's what's fueling the idea of wiping out the light on the planet.
Mm.
And suddenly you go, well, I mean, aside from the jump I had to make to believe there was a god, everything else seems
right,
sound.
That becomes the, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, the most illogical point becomes, imagine there is religion. It's
right.
The opposite of imagine no religion, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, it's the antimatter to that. It's imagine there is religion. Therefore, all of this crazy fucking stuff
happens. All the theoretical science and the applications are completely sound. And so by using the example and having your example be, imagine this crazy thing. Okay, so now in that world, here's the application,
right,
of this theory.
Sure.
And suddenly you go, well, the theory is all sound.
Yeah.
So the only, and I know this is crazy to you and I, but the only suspension of disbelief I have to make in this entire idea is,
right,
so there's a god.
That's the hardest part to believe.
Right.
Which is great that John Carpenter has done the, you know, he's done the math for us all the way up to the end. painting this picture of something that is not like our reality.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken religion to its logical conclusion,
mm-hmm.
which really, it's not even a logical conclusion so much as a literal sense.
Right.
That, hey, there's a devil like scripture describes. He looks like this. He does these evil things. People don't like to think about the Bible literally like that because when you paint that picture, it looks fucking insane.
Right.
And then you have to go, okay, well, where was my math wrong in mm-hmm. that equation? Where did I fuck up?
Right.
And yeah, you're right. You come right back to the beginning where you go, yeah, this looks good. This looks good. There was this kind of dubious part here where I said there is a God and can't really find another step where I totally fucked up.
But I guess a priest said it, so maybe he didn't. And he's a priest that's outside the church, and I guess he's hiring scientists, so he's at least founded in rationality.
Right, right.
I mean, again, the evil Eric becomes so small and difficult to pinpoint. It's smaller than the smallest parts of the atom.
Yeah, lives in the cracks. Ah, thank you, John Carpenter.
And then you predicate an entire violent John Carpenter film on this incredibly fascinating idea. And then you get to do all the gross and all the slit your own throat and all the...
Sure.
Your skin comes off. You get to do all the fun John Carpenter stuff. And it's all predicated on something that your mind is chewing
sure.
the whole time.
I'm surprised people don't talk about Prince of Darkness more because
Agreed.
It seems like the perfect... You got your John Carpenter slasher history.
Mm-hmm.
You got your John Carpenter sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
It's part zombie defend the castle kind of thing that we've talked about before. The assault on Precinct 13
score.
Stuff.
John Carpenter does all the music.
Yeah, right, right. It's this amazing John Carpenter hybrid. And it's also so rarely do we get so far into a movie without knowing what the world is or... I guess we know what the world is. We don't know how to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea what the end game is. It's 20 minutes until the fucking movie's over, and I'm still going, do we just run from ultimate evil?
I mean, yeah.
It's not get out of the house. Do we keep it from getting in? That doesn't. It's not like we're going through tomes
sure.
to go, where's the catch? How mm-hmm. do we... We're just going, man, we're fucked. Let's try right. not to die as long as possible.
And then by the time they introduce the mirror, you're like, right, mirror. Okay, yeah, I get that. That makes sense because, you know.
Oh, we got something. Please do that.
Reflective God. And then the devil starts coming through the mirror and you're thinking, oh, yep, we're fucked. This is the end of the game here. You can't.
Oh, God, especially that moment where she gets pulled in
uh-huh.
and the mirror is shattered.
Yeah.
I literally go, oh, that sucks. Mm-hmm. It's just the weight of, oh, now you're trapped in there with the devil.
So now let's talk about one other thing that I think is one of the most ingenious pieces of this film and something I've never seen in a film, Eric. Mm-hmm. Again, to predicate this, the whole thing, the reason I love this movie is building bullshit on hard fucking facts.
Yeah, right.
Or rather the other way around, I guess, right? You say one stupid thing and then build the genius
yeah,
on
right,
top of
right,
it.
Right. Yeah.
So sure. there's the dreams, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which are, you get the audio that comes through on the dreams and the audio is saying, this is not a dream. We don't have the technology to reach your conscious yet.
Yeah.
However, this is a look at what will happen on this date in this time in this year. We're telling you this to course correct your actions. This is not a dream. They keep doing it, and you get the idea that it's either somebody speaking to them from the future, which is highly unlikely because the film doesn't deal with future
sure,
stock.
Sure.
But instead that it's somebody from the alternate reality with devil god,
uh-huh.
anti-god, the anti-reality, right?
Yeah.
And they're going, okay, listen, and now we're getting into Fringe. These two universes are about to collide. One snow globe is going to destroy the other snow globe.
Right. Thank you.
We don't want to be in the bad snow globe. So here, right. here's us contacting you. This is us crossing the bridge going, listen, this is going to happen. We can't do anything on our end about it because it's a mistake y'all are going to make. So maybe if you guys could just prevent it from happening, that would be awesome. Because then both our universes with our anti-god and your whatever god, they can both live in simultaneous harmony.
Right.
But it's scarier because you see that at the end of the film, the thing that's definitely going to happen is this man's new love comes back to his universe.
Sure.
And if he's the only one they're contacting, suddenly he's immediately faced with, so you get to see this chick again. She'll be back.
Right.
She doesn't seem to be doing anything bad.
Sure.
However, an entire universe is contacting your subconscious, telling you that you need to course correct your actions.
Right.
What do you do?
We got another additional content episode, it being the first of the month. What was the one we did this time?
This time we paired River's Edge with Heathers. It's kind of, you know, teens killing each other for fun or whatever.
Yeah, that got deep. That was, we recorded this one a little bit ago, but do you remember we got in a very strange conversation about turning people in and the nature of the death penalty?
I've since had that conversation again with a group of friends and almost lost friends over it.
Yeah, it's rough. And so I decided to just let this one run on the additional content because it is its own weird little thing. And we have a full out, why the fuck are we talking about this conversation about where the morality lies in turning people you know into the police. All that and more, I suppose. If you're a Kickstarter backer, use the link I sent you in the email before. It's going to take you right to your link for downloading all the additional content episodes you should be seeing. As with before, if you didn't get that email, you should email me. And I will look up your backership and we'll figure it out.
This week, the website is doublefeatureshow.com. We have an email address. You can just type doublefeatureshow@gmail.com and send us all your exciting informational emails.
Hey, last time I asked people to go on iTunes and leave us a nice review with a little write-up. Yeah, please do that. We're sad. Make it happy. We're clearly not sad. Did you just hear us talking? Giggle through this whole show. That helps us out a lot. It helps new people come find the show and think it might actually be worth giving a listen to.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really great if you did that. Go on iTunes, leave a nice little review of the show, give it 5 stars. No stars less than 5 are possibly acceptable. We don't want your real opinion. We just want you to click the 5-star button. And then you can write us an email about everything we do wrong on here and we'll ignore it like usual. Sorry, what were you saying?
I wasn't saying anything, but we do have a list of producers that have already, reviews aside, decided that our show is worth listening to so much that they supported this entire year of Double Feature, and that is Flint Ironstag, Maxwell Harley, Meta Somerville, and Hannah Hughes.
Awesome.
Okay, so we totally stepped in it, Eric, because
what?
At the beginning of this show, we talked about how, oh, these are the best films of all time every week. Next week, we'll probably do, oh, shit, next week we're doing Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz.
God damn it.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.